This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, a forum on Utah's changing demographics and the 2020 census with Mallory Bateman, State Data Center Coordinator at the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. The 2020 census began on April 1st, Census Day. Fill-in census forms have been sent out as the nation begins the enumeration process for the entire population of the United States. It is important to complete the census by mail or online at my2020census.gov as soon as possible. The data from the census informs state and local funding, national representation, and the redrawing of political maps for the next decade. Last year, the rollout of the census was complicated by the potential inclusion of a citizenship question at the request of the Trump administration. After the Supreme Court rejected the change, the question was dropped and was not included in the 2020 census form. Now the census faces another hurdle, with the executive branch demanding the census count be finished by September 30th, a month earlier than the Census Bureau had expected to finish their work. Mallory Bateman explains the issues surrounding the citizenship question, as well as what the census means for Utah after experiencing unprecedented population growth and demographic shifts in the last decade. She also discusses why these changes make the 2020 census a critical piece of data for the state as it looks to address questions of city planning, federal funding, representation, and policies to address specific demographics. This talk was recorded on April 22, 2019.
So thanks for coming out at the end of the semester. I know you're all probably kind of burnt out, but you're really close. So as was mentioned, my name is Mallory Bateman. I'm the State Data Center Coordinator over at the Kem Gardner Policy Institute down the hill from here. And we're under the David Eccles School of Business. So we're part of the U too. I'm going to talk you through some facts about Utah's changing demographics, and especially focusing since 2010. And then I'm going to move into talking about the census. So hopefully there's like at least one nugget of information that's new in here for you. If you're from Utah, this might seem like you know everything, but maybe I'll surprise you. We'll see. So what is the State Data Center? The State Data Center is a partnership program between the Census Bureau and all 50 states, the DC and the island areas. And it used to be the way to get your data locally, when it would come out on microfiche film and you'd have to talk to someone to get, you know, your tabs put together. Now you can get it all online. It's a lot easier. And so the goal of the State Data Center program is to let people know what the Census Bureau does, let them know about the programs, products, and connect you to Census Bureau data. So if you ever have any questions about Census Bureau data, give me a call or email me, because I answer questions from anybody all over the state or from other states looking for information about Utah. So some demographic basics. I'm part of the demographics team at the Gardner Policy Institute. We're a team of five people directed by Dr. Pam Perlick. So if you've seen her speak, she's amazing. And she's our director, a fearless leader. So we are responsible for the population projections for the state. State and county estimates that we put out each year that are reviewed by the Utah Population Committee. And I can talk about that more later if you're interested. And then we also produce sub-county estimates, and those are just in Salt Lake and Utah County, and those are at the census tract level. You can get estimates from the Census Bureau at this level, but they're in five-year estimate windows. So if you kind of want an idea of your neighborhood, maybe a little bit bigger than your neighborhood, the population, this is a good resource to turn to. And these are updated annually as well. So nationally, the Intermountain West has been a spot that is growing pretty consistently throughout the decade. This map looked really similar last year, where Idaho, Nevada, and Utah are the states that have the highest percent population change from the previous year. This is 2017, 2018. Sorry, I realize it's not on there. The beige states, so Wyoming, Illinois, New York, Louisiana, Mississippi, West Virginia, a couple other states on the East Coast had population loss. So the population growth we've been seeing has been fairly constant since we've started taking population data in the state of Utah. Other states don't have that same opportunity or issue, however you want to look at it. And we grew between 2017 and 2018, the Census Bureau estimates show about 1.8% increase. So that puts us up to about 3.16 million people. So that growth has been constant, as I've mentioned, but it's taken varying windows of time. So if you look at when we first hit a million, it was 1966. And then it took 29 years to hit 2 million. And then it took 20 to get to 3 million. And our projections show that time frame getting a little bit shorter, moving forward to get to our next million people. We're actually going to revisit these in 2021 after we get new census estimates or counts. And so we'll see what this looks like in 2021 if these windows change. But because of some things that have been happening with our population makeup, it has accelerated the growth since the 90s especially. So one thing to note is that migration is becoming a more stable influence in our population growth in the state. And on this graph, net migration is the gray. So that's people moving in minus people moving out. And you can see in the 80s, more people were moving out. But now it's become a more stable component of our growth. Natural increase, so that's births minus deaths, that red line on the chart that's never going below zero. That's been what the state relied on for population growth in the earlier decades of the 1900s, up to recently. It's still the majority of our growth, but that difference between migration and natural increase is shrinking. So we also saw, we have a paper that we put out a couple years ago looking at fertility rates in the state. And much like everywhere else, our fertility rates are going down. They're still high. Our total fertility rate actually moved down to number 2 in the nation 2 years ago. So that was big news in our shop. I think it's South Dakota is ahead of us, just barely. We can get into the dynamics of that. If you break it down by age groups and certain populations, there's some very different trends, and we have different trends there than South Dakota. But yeah, people are having fewer children. Less kids in general, waiting until they're older to have kids. So that is impacting that red line going down since 2008. So all those kids that we are having make us the youngest state in the nation. And, you know, if you look back, this goes way back to 1880, but, you know, in 1970, the median age in the U.S. was 28.1, and we were at 23.1 years. We're up to 31, and we're still the youngest state in the nation. So that's compared to 38.1 years nationally. And if we break it down by age group, and this is using our population projections again, that first column on the left is 2015, and that shows about 10% of our population was 65 or older in 2015, and then about 30% of our population was school-age kids, or preschool, 0 to 4, up to 17. So our projections show that that 65 or older chunk of population is going to double by 2065. But that means that's me. That's me not moving, staying in the state. I'm part of that segment of the population. So if you stop and think for a minute how old you're going to be in 2065, gives you kind of a concept of who's going to be your cohort. You know, going along with that lower fertility rate and people having fewer children, that's what how you're seeing that share of children becoming smaller and smaller. But that share of working age people decreases a little bit, but it stays pretty stable because we were projecting on an economy similar to the one we have now that's pretty strong and is a driver for migration to get people to the state. Another thing that has been going on in the state is that our minority share, so that's anyone that isn't identifying as a non-Hispanic white person. That's anyone with Hispanic or Latino origins, and then people falling into the four other race categories, and we'll talk about those on the next slide. You know, if you look back, Utah was a pretty white homogenous state. We're still fairly a white homogenous state, but the share of the minority share of the population is increasing. And so if you look at this graph, US is the gray line, Utah is that brownish line, and then Salt Lake City I threw on here just because it's pretty different, but that's the red line on there. And so the red line and the gray line, US and Salt Lake, are met up around 2000. So Salt Lake is kind of on a different trajectory than the rest of the state. In some areas are pockets of change. West Valley just in the past couple of years, data is showing that they're a minority-majority city. So there's some pretty significant changes, especially on the Wasatch Front. Some smaller towns outside of, you know, the Wasatch Front have pretty different racial and ethnic makeups, but for the large cities, there's a big shift. And so this is just from 2016 to 2017, the growth in the state. And you can see that 41% of our growth was that racial or ethnic minority population. The Census Bureau uses the Office of Management and Budget guidelines for race groups. And so those were determined in 1990 and were determined in 1990. They haven't been updated. So we're going to get into that a little bit farther down when we talk about the census. But as you can see, they're a little bit restrictive. Black, American Indian or Alaska Native, Asian, Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander. And then this other group was introduced of two or more races. And there's also a some other race if you don't feel like you fit into these breakouts. And two or more races, some other race, has been one of the fastest growing segments of our population. And if you look at age groups, younger kids typically fall more in this one, younger generations. And our Asian population has been increasing quite a bit. And so here's our foreign-born population. So these were people born outside of the U.S., and this was just for 2017. So you can see that Latin American-born people are still the majority of our foreign-born population, but that Asian chunk is 21.8%. And if you look at arrival windows, so when people came and entered the U.S., prior to 2010, Latin America was the majority segment, was the majority group of people coming in to Utah. But if you look from 2010 forward, the Asian population actually is about 51%. And if you look into Salt Lake County, it's even bigger. So there have been some interesting shifts in our international migration patterns that, you know, we're tracking through the ACS, and it's interesting to see how things are changing. So just a little recap of all of those changes. It was a lot of stuff to throw at you. But we've added about 339,000 new Utahns, and that's the, oh, I guess I left off 2018. Anyway, we've added a lot of new Utahns since 2010, and they're being estimated through the American Community Survey and through our estimates, but we need to make sure we count them, we know where they are. We've been in the top 10 fastest growing states every year since 2010, and I think when we looked at the 2010 census compared to 2018, we were actually the fastest in that 8 year, had the largest percent increase in that 8 year period. We hit 3 million people. Our population growth components are kind of shifting. Our population is getting older and becoming more diverse. And also, we've had new cities incorporate since 2010. And so it's kind of, I've learned more about incorporation working at the Kemp-Gardner Policy Institute. But they need Census Bureau data to get their tax allocations, especially for, you know, road funding and stuff like that. And so we have to set up a new baseline with these new cities that have incorporated in the past 8 years. So if you haven't been keeping track, the census is only 344 days away. It's so exciting. April 1st is Census Day. And so this year on April 1st, we had a little event where we unveiled the state census logo, gave some updates on the state efforts. As the State Data Center, we're a partner with the governor's office, who is actually in charge of the enumeration outreach for the state. We're working closely together on some of the background elements that help to inform what's going on. So one thing I don't think people really consider is how early planning starts for the census. So it's only once every 10 years, right? And you're trying to count this time around, 328 million was the census clock last night for America, the count. So it's a lot of people to try to get a hold of, count them in the right place once and only once. And so there's a lot of background work, there's a lot of research, looking at the questions, seeing if they can be framed differently, if they can address new populations or changing demographics in a better or different way. And this whole process was a little bit thrown off kilter in the 2017-2018 timeframe due to some funding issues. So some of those tests had to be canceled, and there's some new technology. Online response is going to be available for the first time this census, and you know that testing that they wanted to do had to be cut a little bit short due to funding problems. So this time around, it's going to be interesting to see. People at the Census Bureau are still working hard and doing what they can to make sure that this 2020 enumeration, you know, is the best that we can get. But there have been a couple hiccups in the planning stages. So one thing I want to remind everybody of is the census is the largest peacetime government mobilization, and the federal government is in charge of the census. They're in charge of getting the counts. They're in charge of getting the forms out to everybody or the invitation to respond. They are in charge of hiring. So we have local partnership specialists right now out in the field trying to help communities prepare. But also after the census, having enumerators, so the people that go and knock on the door, if you don't respond, the Census Bureau is in charge of hiring there as well. And then they're also running national media campaigns and outreach efforts. Locally, the state has a complete count committee. So that's a group of interested stakeholders and community members trying to figure out the best ways to reach out to the different communities across the state, different populations. There are a lot of cities and counties that are getting going or have complete count committees, and I'll show you those toward the end. But the local work is more support and kind of back-end work. One thing that people don't think about that's been taking over everything for the past year or so is compiling address lists. Because if you're sending a notice to an address, a mailing address, you have to have a good list to know where you're sending all of this stuff. So we're now in the third part of compiling address lists. There was an invitation out to local entities where they got to submit their own lists. We're gonna be participating in this count review process where we're working with the AGRC, the GIS department of the state, to submit a whole statewide address list to try to ensure that everyone that has a mailing address is gonna get that invitation. Salt Lake County actually did some more grassroots kind of outreach, looking for units that might not show up on a traditional USPS mailing list. And so they went out canvassing, trying to find, if there was a garage apartment or a basement unit where you could see maybe a mailbox or something, but it wasn't clearly marked. So they were trying to increase that and make sure that everyone is enumerated if possible. I keep saying everyone counts. And that's the point of the census, is that it's supposed to count every person living in the US once, only once, and in the right place. And if you listen to any census webinars or interact with them at all, you're gonna hear once, only once, and in the right place like 150 times. But it is important. And another thing to remember with the address lists and counting people in the right place, it's also kind of a count of housing units and to get a better understanding of where people are living all over the US. So why it happens, and all you Hinckley students should know this already, but the Constitution mandates it. The enumeration clause of the Constitution writes out that there needed to be a count. I have all the text here of it. I'm not gonna read it, but the point initially was to be the basis for apportionment of representatives and also basis for direct taxes. The direct tax thing kind of didn't work out because the apportionment was such a contentious fight. If you want to know more about that, I have a great book that goes through every decade of census and like how government entities were arguing over how best to decide apportionment. All of the census background work is to produce counts of people and housing units. And those numbers are important for three main reasons, well, three big overarching kind of umbrella reasons. And I'm gonna touch on all of them, but the first I'm gonna hit is planning. As I mentioned before, we produce the population projections for the state, and the census numbers are our baseline. We're not the only people producing projections. Anybody that's producing some kind of projection related to the population is likely utilizing census data because it's the only opportunity where you get a really complete count. You're never going to get everybody, but you're also not going to have opportunities throughout the decade where you have so many people being counted at once. There's another survey, the American Community Survey, that goes out each year, but it goes out to a small sample of the population. So this is the opportunity to really try to get the best understanding of some basic characteristics of the population. And since we've had growth as a constant throughout Utah's history, we have a history of planning too. And so we've got these planning exercises, we've got transportation planning, planning for education, city planning in general. I did urban planning as an undergrad. So for me, it's like, well, no, duh. Like, you need numbers. You need to know who's going to be living here. But we have a long history of trying to plan for the people who are going to be moving here. And without a good baseline, we're stuck with the numbers we have for the next 10 years. So that's an important thing for me, is just remembering you get this opportunity once every 10 years. And if it gets messed up, you're kind of out of luck until the next decade rolls around. Another huge reason why the census is important is funding. And you know, the examples that we use in our framework is more getting federal funding out to states, to counties, to local entities. George Washington University, their Institute of Public Policy, is doing a great series of research looking at the impacts of funding and breaking it down to state level. So thankfully for us, they're doing a lot of heavy lifting. Their most recent report looked at 55 programs that use census-derived data sets to fund states. And the fiscal year 2016 number that they had was, I think it's $5.7 billion came to Utah. And we're not a state that takes a lot of federal money, right? Like, we try to be this independent state, but we're still taking a lot of federal funding. And it's really impactful to our state budget, even though it's not as large as in some other states that are taking larger shares of federal funding. If you break that down using the estimates from 2016, it's about almost $1,900 per person counted. So it's not a direct thing. It's also not a complete audit of every funding resource that utilizes Census Bureau data to figure out their funding allocation, but it gives you an idea of, you know, one pretty big pot of money that's divvied out using those Census Bureau numbers. And the last one that's really important, again, they're all really important. I'm not going to say one's more important than the other, is representation. How many people were in Utah in 2000? Handful, kind of. Okay, so in 2000, Utah was neck and neck with North Carolina to get a fourth congressional seat. And due to some hot deck imputation was the method used by the Census Bureau, North Carolina got the seat by some very, very small number of people. And so Utah was fired up. They sued the Department of Commerce saying, you know, we've been wronged and our seat was not allocated appropriately, in part due to our large missionary population. Military members are counted, but not missionaries. There's a lot of logic to that. It's a lot easier to follow people that the federal government has a direct connection to. But that was a big reason with North Carolina getting that seat. We didn't get victory in that lawsuit, but that made everyone pretty pumped for 2010. So 2010, we did obviously get that fourth congressional seat. This time around, I haven't seen anything showing us gaining or having any changes in our DC representation. This map shows you the orange states are the ones predicted to lose. I think this is out of North Carolina, so they're highlighting their state getting another one. They're excited again. But I've also seen Montana highlighted as a state that might get another seat, so they'd be up to two. They're pretty excited. They're doing a lot of outreach. But a state has to lose a seat in order for another state to gain a seat. So it's maintaining this balance. So it'll be fun to watch. It also might be impacted by certain questions and response rates. So there's an interesting article that was on the New York Times. I can't think of what the name of it is, but it's Emily Badger is the author of this article, and she looked at the impact if there were significant undercounts in certain populations, how that would impact the allocation of seats, and it's pretty interesting analysis. So even though we're not seeing any changes in our national representation, we're going to see changes locally, because the numbers out of the census are used for districts from state senate to city council to school district. It's impacting every boundary where we're voting. And so it's still important to turn in, to answer the census. For some people that are involved, it seemed like if we're not gonna have anything going on in DC, why are we gonna really worry about this? It's like, well, we still have all of our local government that's impacted by this. So let's not take our foot off the gas on this just because the one big golden egg is different.
That was Mallory Bateman, State Data Center Coordinator at the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Today, Mallory Bateman, a State Data Center Coordinator, explains the importance of the census and why accurate data is important to the state. Here, once again, is Mallory Bateman.
So as I've mentioned kind of throughout this, the census is a short questionnaire. I was trying to look up the shortest questionnaire in the 2000 like press materials were like, this is the shortest questionnaire in 180 years. It's going to be so great. So they've maintained this short questionnaire into the 2020 census. And these questions, these main questions, age, Hispanic origin, race, relationship to the householder, typically that's the mortgage holder or person on the lease, sex, which is just binary, tenure is renting or owning, and then citizenship was proposed. And then there are some operational questions just to kind of clarify, but these questions are asked of every person living in a housing unit. And that's all you get out of the census. And so the ACS, that American Community Survey, gives you that deeper dive into characteristics. It's like 26 pages long. It is very thorough. If you get it, I know it seems onerous, but you should still fill it out because we need that sample returned so we can have a better understanding. The long form of the census used to provide this deeper dive and then was replaced by the ACS in 2010 to try to give a more up-to-date look at the population. If you're in a population with 65,000 people or more, you get estimates each year. Otherwise, you get five-year estimate windows at smaller populations. So you get, a little glimpse into how things are changing. It might be a bit of a interesting analysis when you have a five-year window, but it's something. So I'm going to dive into a couple questions where there have been changes or additions, and just highlight a couple things. So relationship is one of the, almost original census questions. The first census was in 1790, so it took a little while to get on here. That first census cared mostly about white male landowners, and that was the big focus. So we've evolved. And this time around, 2020, the proposal is to include same-sex partners, whether married or unmarried, give them a box to check. In 2010, if people, same-sex couples, tried to note that they were a couple on a form, they were actually recoded in the data as heterosexual opposite-sex couples. So it's good to have this because there are a couple, I think UCLA has an institute that is trying to delve into this data and provide some insights, but it'll be nice to have this moving forward. Another question that is getting changed is race. So as I mentioned, there's the five race groups, and then there's ethnicity, which is just Hispanic Latino origin. That goes back to the 70s and is a whole nother thing, but this question, this rephrasing of the race question, is to try to get at origins, so we have a little bit more idea of who people are. There was a proposed Middle Eastern North African addition to the race question that was going through development and then kind of got canned. And so this is sort of the compromise. And I know you probably can't read it because it's teeny and far away, but if you look at white, they have print, for example, German, Irish, English, Italian, Lebanese, Egyptian. Black or African American includes Jamaican, Haitian, Nigerian, Ethiopian, Somali. And, you know, if you're part of a Native American tribe, they want you to highlight that. I'm really curious how this is going to play out with this open-ended response. I'm very curious what's going to happen. There are questions about ancestry on the American Community Survey, so I guess there's sort of a baseline, and they put this on here for a reason. They feel confident that they're going to get some good data, but I think it will be very interesting to see what we get out of this question. The Hispanic Latino, I believe, stayed, or I think they added the another open-ended response. So if you don't fall into, you know, the three categories they highlight or countries of origin they highlight, you can put in your own background. So the last question that was added in 2017 and was not included on the proposed topics in 2016, which were given to Congress, is citizenship question. This question is directly from the ACS, so it's the same format that is used on that sample-based American Community Survey. there were 250,000 comments on the Federal Register notice about all the questions, but they were all targeted toward citizenship. And if you interact with Federal Register notices, 250,000 comments is like mind-blowing, right? You're like, oh my gosh, we got like 150 comments about our wetland, you know, fix, and no one's looking at those. So the fact that this, I actually do. So if you're ever curious what's going on the Federal Register, send me a note. But yeah, so this is a contentious one. The research that the Census Bureau did around this looked at three different situations. One was using administrative data, one was asking this question, and one was kind of a combo of both. On the American Community Survey, this question is not very reliable. Their analysis, when comparing with administrative data, shows that I think something like 30% of respondents don't answer this accurately, or at least with what is shown in other administrative records. So this being on the proposed list of questions is the most expensive and least effective way, according to the Census Bureau internal research, to try to ascertain whether people are citizens or not. So extra pertinent because it's being heard tomorrow at the Supreme Court. The first decision that came out, so obviously 250,000 comments, people were interested, and immediately a lot of lawsuits came out. The first one that was decided was in New York, and it was on the basis that the Secretary of Commerce didn't follow administrative procedure, the Administrative Procedures Act, when adding this on. So he just didn't follow the rules, and so that's what they were claiming. The court ruled in favor of New York, and it was a combined effort. It was a bunch of cities, counties, New York, and some NGO entities. There's still some going, but there are two other ones that were have some kind of one level of resolution, one in California and one in Maryland. California and Maryland were also on that Administrative Procedures Act, saying that he didn't follow the rules, but then also that it was in violation of the enumeration clause because it's going to impact the count. It's going to stop this tool from being used to get a complete count of the population. And the judge in both of those situations decided that the Administrative Procedures Act wasn't followed and that it was in violation of the enumeration clause. So that's what the Supreme Court, number two, I tried to paraphrase from their legalese. I think that's what they're getting at, is looking at if you can look at other people. So there were other people involved that potentially had input on this question that were outside of the Commerce Department, were other people in the administration. I don't think any of them are still there, but looking at those people's outward behaviors, if that can be included in the discovery, if that impacted the decision that was made. So I'm really curious what's going to happen. I'm watching it closely. researchers. There's a lot of thinking it's not a good idea. It's not going to get the results that they're striving to get. The State Data Center submitted all of us combined submitted a note on that Federal Register notice saying that the citizenship question, if it has to be on here, shouldn't be required. Because if it was on there right now and you didn't check any box, it would trigger a non-response follow-up. So someone would come to your house like you didn't respond at all. So we'll see. There has to be a decision by June because there still will be printed materials and those have to go through all of the, you know, bureaucratic processes starting in June, July. So it'll be a quick turnaround. We'll see. There's been some damage done already, but it's also reminding people that there is a census. So sometimes, you know, try to look for that silver lining. And this, your data are confidential, and that's one thing that has been a big concern with a lot of different individuals, agencies, you know, is that that question would be used for nefarious purposes. The Census Bureau is guided by Title 13, which has some strict guidelines that they can't share personal level information with anybody. And if you do, you can be faced with up to 5 years in federal prison and a $250,000 fine. The Census Bureau is really adamant about sticking up for Title 13, following Title 13. They don't want to lose the public's trust. They realize this is a big, you know, you're sending in your name, you're sending in your age, and it's a lot. it can be, it's a huge trust exercise, which is funny because it's government. You don't necessarily think of, like, trust exercises. But they're really sticking to this. If you look back in the history of the Census Bureau, there were some times when data wasn't used for the most upstanding reasons. Title 13 was implemented, I think, in the 70s, and so that is the new framework for moving forward. There's also guidance with the Patriot Act, where census data does not fall under the umbrella of data that can be pulled with the Patriot Act, so at least there's that. I started trying to go through all of the things I could find, and it's a dense body of work, so I'm hoping GW also looks at that or some other institute can do a deep dive. So this comes from the Census Barriers, Attitudes, and Motivators study, where the Census Bureau recognizes that there could be some issues. And it's actually a really interesting study. If you're interested in this kind of stuff at all, you can go and grab the whole report. But this one just shows how likely people would be to fill out their census form, and it's by age group. And the older generations, I mean, not that old, 45 and older, are more likely to fill it out than 18 to 34-year-olds. And so I just want to take this moment to remind anyone who's a student that you are traditionally a hard-to-count population because you are mobile. You might assume your parents are filling out, like putting your name on their census form. They're not. You're supposed to be, you know, where you live for the bulk of your year is the address you should be filling out the form at. It doesn't seem fun, but it's going to be online, so that'll be a blast. So I know that we all have some feelings about government or big data or connecting to this bigger network, but if you're not counted, then you definitely are not going to be represented. So I would recommend not following the CBAM's research and responding to the census. So this one is from the Census Bureau, and it's just showing that they understand that there's a lot going on that is potentially going to impact the ability to get a complete count. Mobile population, as I mentioned, the constrained fiscal environment that impacted the testing and is potentially going to impact moving forward. An increasingly diverse population, the distrust in government. And then we've also got online response for the first time this time around. And it's a big deal. They're not going to have an app, is what I've been told, but that might change. Who knows? We're having a meeting of the State Data Center people in June, so I hope we're going to get more information. But it's a really light, really easy to use web interface that you'll be able to pull up on your phone. It will be secure. It'll be encrypted or all the words you're supposed to have. I'm not really into that stuff, so I can point you to the documents if you want to know more about that. But the hope was that this would be a cost-cutting measure and it would also make it easier and kind of increase response rates. So this is a figure that's just showing 95% of households are going to get an invitation to respond with the request that you go online and fill out the form online. You can, if you're not comfortable filling it out online, you can still request a paper copy of the form and mail it in. You would just have to note that on the postcard that's sent out. And then, you know, the remaining 5% are going to have a different treatment. This map shows those types of enumeration areas. So the purpley-gray color are the ones that are going to be getting the postcard asking you to respond online. And then the beige color is update leave, and so that will be someone hand-delivering, a paper form to a door. So in a lot of these areas, you might not have traditional mailing addresses. Actually, the strongest beige areas are tribal areas, and so they have a different, you know, street system. Sometimes they don't. If you're using a PO box, the Census Bureau doesn't want your PO box. They want it at your door. So that will be a more direct connection. But I just want to note, even though it looks like 50% of the state is beige, 75% of the population lives up in that top chunk of purple where the Wasatch Front is. So obviously, we have populations outside of the Wasatch Front, and you've got another 5% up in Cache Valley and then down in Washington County. But you have most of the population covered by that postcard coming out. So even though our geography might look like one thing, most people will be covered with that postcard invitation.
That was Mallory Bateman, State Data Center Coordinator at the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Once more, here is Mallory Bateman, State Data Center Coordinator at the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute.
So if you're really interested in the census and you want to know what you can do, you can try to get involved with your local complete count committee. And this is a list I had a couple months ago. I'm guessing there are more on here. And if you're interested, I can connect you with the people who have the master list. But I think it would be good to have more diverse voices on the complete count committees. I know sometimes working with local government, you get the same players at each little meeting or stakeholder committee. And so if you're interested in this, I would suggest reaching out to your city council person or your mayor and finding out if you can get involved, because I think the more voices at the table with different, you know, concepts of who the population is, who our neighbors are, the better and the more useful that you could be. You can also, you know, if you're really close with your city council or mayor and they don't know what you're talking about, the Census Bureau has some great resources available. They have got some toolkits kind of walk you through the process. Our partnership specialists, this is actually their job, is to get these committees up and going across the state. So you could also, you know, send them to me and I'll send them to the partnership people if they don't know who they are. And then the last thing you can do, if you don't know what you're doing next spring and you're a little worried, you could at least have a couple months of pretty good pay, flexible hours, working from home, being outside in the spring weather, and be an enumerator. They're going to be hiring, and hopefully our economy stays how it is, and it's different than in 2010. In 2010, everybody and their dog and their grandma needed and wanted a job, and so hiring the enumerators was very easy. This time around, we're in a much tighter labor market, and so the census is a teeny bit worried about getting these local partners, just because, you know, we're in a very different place. The best enumerators also are already connected. You know your community. If you've got language skills in your community, use them here, and You can show that this is just data that informs really baseline stuff. It's very important. It's kind of the foundation of our democratic establishment. So depending, whatever you think is the most important,
Element. This is a good way to get involved. And that's the end of my presentation. So if anyone has any questions, I'll try to answer them. If I don't have your answer, I will take it back with me and look it up and get it to you. But otherwise, thanks for hanging out for 45 minutes.
If you have a question, just raise your hand and we'll bring the microphone around.
So there's the question about same-sex partnerships, mm-hmm. but will there ever be any data collected on just residents who identify with the LGBTQ community? So ones who may not be in a relationship or maybe same-sex marriage doesn't describe their mm-hmm. experience as an LGBT person.
I think they kind of started looking into it this time around and decided to focus their energies on that question. I have a feeling moving forward it's going to show up, but it's not necessarily the most adaptable instrument. So I would say keep watching it. If it's important, let your representatives know. There are also some representatives that aren't for Utah, but they're very into census issues. So if you want to get in contact with them as well and let them know. But yeah, the evolution of some of these questions moves at a very bureaucratic pace. So it might be a moment until we get there. I know that the UCLA study, I think it has a broader look at the population. So I can't think of the institute right now, but they've got some really good data points.
I'd like to bring up ethnicity a little bit. I think it's such a jumbled mess right now. You know, that a lot of people, you know, when you try to just focus into one particular group or ethnic group or something, a lot of people don't even know or don't even understand. I mean, there's just such, it's hard to just really centralize ethnicity anymore. And I hate to see it turned into, from the census point of view, to a political potato, to the advantage of politicians that are just saying, okay, I'm going to appeal to this certain group and this certain group because based on race or something like that, you see. And, you know, this thing about ethnicity is really tough to do nowadays.
With the
way things are changing with immigration coming in, I'd like to know how is the census really going to focus and address that particular issue?
I mean, the addition of the race question and ethnicity, especially Hispanic origin, was due to civil rights. Right? Communities weren't being identified. They weren't counted anywhere. They weren't being recognized. And so that was kind of the initial impetus. Part of it. There's some other parts of the whole race and ethnicity question that are just framed in xenophobia and racism if you go pretty far back. And so it is definitely tricky because we're increasingly diverse. And communities want to be recognized, especially if there's the potential that, you know, there's funding or representation that could be connected to that. But you're limited because you want to try to have a big umbrella, but you also need to know details about the population. And it's only going to keep getting more diverse. So it's going to be trickier and trickier each decade moving forward.
Hi. From April 1st, how long does it take you to get to the point where you are confident that you can release the data that you have as being accurate? And what percent accuracy do you guys anticipate getting for this?
So part of the enumeration clause is getting numbers to the president by the end of 2020. So the end of December, numbers have to be handed over for apportionment. And then those numbers are sent out to the states. The other summary file type stuff is going to be coming out in the spring or summer of 2021. And there's a lot going on in the background right now on differential privacy because they want to make sure people that know how to really dig into data can't figure out that your response is, you know, ID number whatever. So I can send you some information on that really detailed differential privacy because I think that's going to impact the reliability. They want to maintain pretty strong reliability, but they also need to keep people non-identifiable, and it's kind of a tricky balance for anyone doing research at a, you know,
more local level, finding that balance. So I could send you more detailed information. I don't know the exact numbers, so I don't want to be throwing anything out there. Okay. Thanks, guys.
If you'd like to hear another Hinckley Forum, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Hinckley Institute podcast. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.